Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
As winter approaches, the news on the homeless front is profound. The new figures from the National Center on Family Homelessness found that one out of every 45 children in the country are without a home, the majority of which are 7 years old or younger. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In our studio is Jim Barnes. He's administrator at the Christian Shelter, also Sister Connie at Joseph's House, and also a pre-taped interview with Brenda Jordan. She's with the Salisbury University Social Work Department. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
A couple of things that actually struck me as I was preparing for this show. One, there's a report out by the U.S. Conference of Mayors. It was yesterday. It says a survey of 29 cities shows hunger has risen in most of them in the past year and is expected increase in 2012 as the United States faces a sluggish economy. And homelessness has also rose an average of 6% for the surveyed cities, with the increase in homeless families far outpacing the number of individuals. We also had a report just out which indicates that squeezed by rising living costs, a record number of Americans, nearly one in two now, have fallen into poverty or are scraping by on earnings that classify them as low income. Then our latest census data really depicts a middle class that is shrinking as the unemployment stays high and government safety net is fraying. And those are just a couple of the figures I came across. And I wanted to get your reaction to those numbers. Are those any surprise to you, Jim? Is that a number of surprise to you at all, the state of the economy?
That's been pretty much reflected in what we've seen at Christian Shelter, that a significant increase in not only in the number of folks who are homeless, but also in the number of families now, the makeup of the homeless community. We've seen a lot more families.
What do you think that says about our nation, the fact that we have this? I mean, obviously, we are in a deep recession. That's a given. But nonetheless, half the people in poverty, child homelessness up. What does that say about us?
Well, that's not good. That's not good. I think it says that we are as vulnerable as any other people on the face of this earth to economic changes and shifts and changes in leadership and changes in policy that affect these kind of numbers. But it's not a surprise to me, by and large, progress has kind of unplanned and unanticipated consequences that show up, and somewhere down the line, a society that's been steadily increasing in wealth and prosperity and production and everything year after year, there's a point at which the consequences of that nobody looks at, of that kind of progress, that is, the folks who aren't able to keep up and keep pace with that progress, there comes a time when that begins to come to the surface and be visible, as to say, it's not an endless rise to bigger and better and richer and fuller. It isn't. Sooner or later, you begin to see what's been going on all along, that there have, year after year, there have been people that the faster the pace gets and the higher the economy gets, there are people that aren't able to keep up for a variety of reasons, and they tend to fall by the wayside. And you can kind of avoid that or dodge it for a certain length of time, but sooner or later, this begins to become very apparent that we got a lot of folks out there who are in trouble. And often those folks are in trouble because they haven't been able to keep pace, keep up this incredible pace and stay on top.
Sister Connie, what about you? What's your reaction to those numbers? Are they any surprise to you?
They're not really any surprise to me. Our numbers of homeless that come to us at our homeless day shelter are always increasing, and we're always pretty full at our residence for homeless men where they can get their lives together. I think it shows probably a lack of sensitivity of the people as a whole, not that they're not giving people. I think that, for example, Salisbury is a very, very generous town when it comes to those in need. Perhaps it's just not getting the message out as to just what kind of dire circumstances people are actually living in. One thing that strikes me is when the weather gets very, very cold, we're all warned to bring in our cats and dogs. But are we warned about bringing in the homeless?
I mean, and in many ways, actually, the efforts here in Salisbury, the churches really have taken up a lot of what's been going on. I know when I first came here, which was in around 2003, 2004, it didn't seem as if anyone was doing anything, and the churches got together with a rotating effort and an emergency project. And that's one I want to then now turn to our next guest, who I talked to earlier in the week. We now turn to Brenda Jordan with the Salisbury University's Social Work Department. She's been involved with the Community Emergency Shelter Project, which was partnered with the churches here in Salisbury. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why don't you first of all describe a little bit about how this partnership with the churches came about, and what was the impetus for creating this in the first place?
The impetus was that two homeless men froze to death in the winter of 2004, and it really became a grassroots effort to do something about it. And the Joseph House was trying to do shelter that year, but just lack of resources, it became too much. So they basically put out a call for help. And the social work department professor Claire Weaver, and Dr. David Tontanos from the Ministerial Alliance formed a partnership. And we recruited churches. I was asked to coordinate at that time, and we started out with four churches that first year, the winter of 2005, and we're up to about 15 host sites now. And basically, churches open their doors for a week or 2 weeks at a time. Men come in about 5 o'clock, get a hot meal, stay the evening, and leave the next morning at about 7 a.m. So they get a breakfast in the morning and then lunch to go if they desire.
Do you have any sense about why this wasn't done before? I mean, I remember coming to Salisbury within a couple of years earlier, and one of the things that struck me was that the city didn't seem like it was doing a lot. The county didn't seem like it was. In other words, the government institutions didn't seem to be acting so much. And as you say, we had a couple of people who froze to death. Why do you think there was this lack of movement, of more concern earlier in the game?
Well, I think nobody really wants to take responsibility, or sometimes it's a sense that there's really not a problem. And it really took, you know, human life loss to really get the folks moving. And thank goodness for the people of the Salisbury area who really stepped up and made this happen. And, you know, it's a commitment. It takes a lot of resources. You know, the faith-based community has really been taking the burden that should be shared by, you know, the community and city government. So,
well, let me ask you this. Now, have we seen, do you think, an increase in the folks who are homeless or seeking shelter, seeking help? I mean, that was in 2005. The recession, of course, began in 2007. And I know we've seen a lot of pressure on, say, for instance, the food pantries.
Absolutely. We see about 150 different men move through our shelter in a 3-month span. Some of those you know, use the shelter every evening. Some use it for a couple nights and move on. But certainly, every individual has a story, and it's just a lot of problems with certainly economics. Poverty plays into it. We generally see, I think we serve the chronic homeless that, for whatever reason, cannot maintain stable housing, and certainly there's substance abuse issues, mental health issues, in a lot of the clientele that we see. The trends we've seen, majority of our clients are African American, and we've seen younger homeless people, which has been an interesting turn. So we kind of filled the gap with adult males who wouldn't necessarily be eligible for traditional emergency shelter housing.
Is there anyone that you met who was homeless, who struck you?
I think the talents that these folks, some of these men have, you know, it's not unusual to go into the church and, you know, see a man playing the piano and something like that. You know, a lot of these men do work, but, you know, just can't afford housing. I guess the one that kind of tugs at my heartstrings was a fella who talked about he had witnessed his child being hit by a train and killed, and that just really impacted his life, and he just could not get things together from that point on, and you know, has been homeless for many years. There's a lot of sad stories, and there's a lot of successes. A lot of times the churches are gathering around these men and actually help them, you know, in any way that they can to break the cycle of homelessness.
Do you think, by the way, that local government or state government or the government should be doing more here? I mean, this almost seems as if it's sort of a grassroots effort, and certainly in the sense of the churches on the one hand, and of course there's the university on the other. Do you think that there should be a greater role for government in general?
It would be wonderful if there was. You know, a lot of the churches will say, you know, it would be nice if we had a set location where we could just rotate in, you know, the volunteers to help with the project. But it's as much of a government responsibility, I think, as a personal one. And right now, the faith community is doing their part.
We've been speaking with Brenda Jordan. She's with the Salisbury University Social Work Department and has been involved in the Community Emergency Shelter Project. And we appreciate you taking the time to stop and talk with us.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
And we're back in studio with Jim Barnes. He's with the Christian Shelter and also Sister Connie. She's with Joseph's House. And Sister Connie, actually, you and I talked a number of years ago when I first actually got here, because I remember that, and you talking about how it was getting cold. It was very cold, as a matter of fact. I think there was snow on the ground, I think, when I talked to you.
Right.
And you were putting people in and trying to find places wherever you could. And this was really, in part, really, I think really even before the churches finally got together and put it together. Why
right.
do you think, I want to put the same question to you that I did to Brenda, why do you think it is that something wasn't done before? I mean, I know we had the deaths, the people who, the 2 men had frozen, but, and you mentioned that the community is a generous community, but it seemed like it took time for it to wake up.
It does seem like it took time for it to wake up, and like Brenda suggested, maybe it did take shedding of blood to come to the realization that something had to be done.
Did people talk at all about this? I mean, before the churches finally put this program together for the cold?
Well, I think that when we started taking people into Joseph House, which we did for 24/7 for 2 months, I believe it was, we took the people in. We just put them anywhere. We put them in between the dining room tables. We put them in the interview booths. We put them wherever, in the halls, wherever we could. And the tricky part about it was that we had to get them out during the day over into our hospitality room, because we had to function as a crisis center that we always had functioned as. So it was very, very tricky there. And Now I'm losing my train of thought.
It was a crazy time. I mean, because I remember that.
It was a very crazy time. I think you came to interview us right when we started. Right?
I think
when
so.
When we were starting. Because I think we were, the people had died, and we had called around to the city and the county, and no place was open for the homeless people to go. And so we said, well, that's it. We have to do it. They have to be inside and not outside. And so we're just doing this. We have to do this because we didn't want any more blood on our hands, so to speak.
Jim, what about you? You watch this as well. I mean, you've been at the Christian Shelter for a very long time. What's your take on why it didn't happen sooner?
Well, it began to happen. The Christian Shelter, in fact, started back in 1979 with a group of folks who used to get together on Tuesday mornings for breakfast and prayer from several of the churches around the area. And this was back in 1979, and these people started to talk about and felt a real burden for the problem of folks who don't have any place to live. And so they began to research it a little bit and find out what is being done for these folks. And I think in their case as well, one of the factors that spurred this was a death. Somebody dying who was homeless on the street in the winter. But they began to get together and talk about it and pray about it, and they felt that God was kind of leading them to do something, but they said, what can we do? We have no experience, we have no money, we have no buildings. What do we do about this? And they felt that God was saying, you keep praying and I'll show you. I'll begin to unfold things for you. And that's kind of how it happened with them. But this was all the way back 30 years ago that this group of people just felt like, and they were, these were church people and people who were kind of serious believers who just felt this is a problem and someone needs to do something. And we don't know how to do it, but we're willing. And that willingness was what God was able to use, and a little further down the line, why one of the local churches said, we've got an old building on our property. You could use that as a shelter if you wanted to. And they rallied volunteers to help repair the thing and put it into shape. And that was how the whole thing started. So there has been a concern on the part of people. But, you know, one of the factors, you asked Brenda the question, do you think the government should be doing more about this? And I thought about that, and I said, well, who's the government? The government in this country is by the people, of the people, and for the people. So are the people responsible? Well, yeah. I think our people need to shape up a little bit. and by saying that, I think there are two factors in our culture, in our American culture over the years that have changed, that have made a big difference in how we deal with folks who can't keep up and folks who are in trouble. And these are factors that have to do with, I think, with family, because I think family has been, the whole notion of family has been breaking down and disappearing over the years, and families have gotten weaker and much more fractured and broken. And the other one is the idea of God and belief in God, which has kind of been gradually cleaned out of governments and schools and public places, and we're sort of getting rid of God. And I think those two factors make a big difference in the way the people in general tend to respond to folks who are in need and hurting and in trouble. And weak and broken families, it used to be the family unit was a tremendous source of support if you ran into hard times and difficulty, you could get help from your family. You didn't have to go to the government. And the other piece, the piece of faith, that's been a tremendously valuable thing for people, particularly who run into sudden, unexpected tragedy or difficulty in their lives. And there's a, as a consequence, there's kind of a response of mental confusion and anxiety and despair and hopelessness. And faith in God has been a thing that's enabled people to somehow weather it through a time of crisis and come out on the other end. But when you begin to eliminate God and faith from our society, very openly and obviously eliminate him, that leaves kids growing up without that resource.
Well, as a matter of fact, I want to turn to children because there was a hearing on Capitol Hill, I think it was yesterday. It was held by an Illinois congressional member, Judy Biggert, who's chairing some legislation. And one of the people who testified about her experience as someone who was homeless, a Brandon Dunlop. She's 25 now. And, quote, even though I worked throughout high school, there was no way I could afford my own housing or find someone to rent an apartment to a teenager. Although people at school helped me with other things, nobody was able to help with my housing situation. I would have loved some place that was safe, warm, and consistent to live, a healthy place to live my life, to go to school, work, and go to one place to do my homework and eat. Now, I know that you take in families and children. What have you seen an increase in the number of children showing up on your doorstep? And, and what is that? And what does that do to a child?
Oh, that I think that has a devastating effect on kids to be in a homeless situation because it's all of a sudden instability, the notion that the tremendous vulnerability. We've got no home. We got no place to live now. What do we do? It creates a lot of confusion and tension and generally failing grades in school or not being able to concentrate and do well in school, and that's tough on the kids. And again, family, change in family situations has affected that, because so often we see children come in with a single parent, usually the mother, and there is no, the kids grow up never seeing somebody in the family who goes to work every day and comes home and brings a paycheck home at the end of the week and looks after the family. Imagine the effect on kids that grow up never seeing that, never having anybody ask them how they did in school when they get home at night. No books in the house. Nobody reading anything. That has quite an impact on the way that child grows up, and as they come into adulthood, the way they respond to the world around them.
Sister Connie, what about, have you seen a change in the kinds of people that you're seeing now show up at your doorstep? I mean, we've had this recession, so obviously that it's had an impact. As I mentioned before, I think it's one out of two now. People are living around the poverty line. What kind of changes have you seen in the people who are showing up there where you are?
Well, I guess it's really not too much of a change. We just are always seeing new people, and I guess that's something that really strikes us, is how many new people are coming to Joseph House each day. They're just in a situation that they've never been in before. And I haven't really noticed necessarily very many children coming to our hospitality center during the day.
Are there a number of who work and still can't afford to have a place to stay? Have you seen either one of you?
Yes. That happens. And I feel very strongly that what the homeless need most is a home. They need a home. They need a permanent home. Shelter is good, and it has a beginning and an end as far as the time when they can stay there, but they need the security of a home. They need to feel like they belong somewhere, and they can work on their self-esteem. I mean, how much self-esteem can you have when you're just going around begging from door to door and don't know where you're going to sleep at night? How do we get that? How do we get to the point where everybody can have a home? Well, I don't know, but I was in Baltimore one time and I heard them saying, and I don't know how many years they put on it, but they said that they're attempting to eradicate homelessness in Baltimore City in so many years. I don't know whether that was 5 years or 10 years or what, but I thought, this is really where it's at, is to make yourself a goal like that, because people just, they can't function well as homeless people. And when you think about the government and the and getting some help from them, yes, that would be fine, because they're really paying a price tag now. They're really paying a price tag now, because all of these homeless people are getting sick. They have no health care. Their bills at the hospital are sky high. And if they could take some of that money and put it into some places that could be permanent housing, I think they would come back out on the winning side.
Well, I wanted to ask you, both of you, before the program wraps up, is there any one individual that strikes you that you remember who was homeless, symbolizes what the problem is, or anyone that I know I asked Brenda the same thing. Either one of you? Connie, is there anybody that you recall as an individual that you really remember?
I guess I remember one man who was... he was an alcoholic, and he tried many times getting sober, and he never could quite get there, and eventually he just died out in the woods somewhere. I remember people like that, that just no matter what we had to offer, it wasn't enough. Maybe if we were able to offer a home, even if the person was having an addiction problem. I think it's been shown even in New York that even if you take in people with an addiction problem, they're going to do better. They're eventually going to get it faster than if they did not have a home.
Jim, what about you? Anybody remember, strike you?
I think of two people recently, two women, that are, in fact, a real contrast. One of them was a woman who came to us who was homeless because of sudden, very unexpected tragedy that she couldn't do anything about. The other one was a woman who had been homeless off and on for years with four children. Both of them came through the shelter, were with us for about a month or so, and were able to get back on their feet. Both with very different stories, and the woman who it was an older woman whose husband had suddenly died, and she just wasn't able to. She had always been a stay-at-home housewife, and so she wasn't equipped or able to maintain the family, and everything fell apart. And she was a basket case when she came into the shelter, full of confusion and just doubt and fear. But at the end of 30 days, her whole perspective on who she was and what her life was about had changed. And she all of a sudden felt like, yes, I can do it. There is hope. And she's doing very well right now. The other woman, again, it was a case of she just wasn't equipped to be able to deal with four children with no husband. And she just could never quite pull it together. And again, after a period of time in the shelter, mostly, I think the thing that affected her the greatest was probably some of the disciplines that we required in the shelter that helped her learn how to pull and organize things and make decisions carefully and thoughtfully. That helped her get back on her feet. She got a job, and now she has a place. She's hanging on by the skin of her teeth, but she's hanging on.
Should also mention, by the way, as we wrap up the program, that the city of Salisbury apparently has accepted $39,000 from the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development's Emergency Solutions Grant, and it's going to be aiding Diaconia, Village of Hope, Second Chance Help, as well as Samaritan Ministries, in terms of trying to help out the homeless. And that is one of the other efforts that is now being carried out here in the city of Salisbury. We've been talking with Jim Barnes. He's the administrator at the Christian Shelter. Also, Sister Connie at Joseph's House. And also, earlier in the program, we talked with Brenda Jordan. She's with the Salisbury University Social Work Department. She's also been involved with the Community Emergency Shelter Project, which has partnered with the churches in the area to help the homeless. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.